Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Young Castro, The Making of a Revolutionary by Jonathan M. Hansen. Narrated by Timothy Andres Pabon. History is a product of so many different interpretations and points of view that it's hard to be sure that true history exists. Years from now, if historians describe what happened in Cuba today, what will they say? How close will they get to the facts? What will they get wrong? Fidel Castro, 1992. Preface. Tengo material abundante para el estudio de los grandes movimientos políticos contemporáneos, socialismo, fascismo y nazismo. Fidel Castro wrote Nati Revuelta in April 1954. Pero no tengo nada del New Deal de Roosevelt. I have plenty of material about the great political movements, socialism, fascism, and Nazism, but nothing about Roosevelt's New Deal. At the same time, Castro was serving the 9th month of a 26-year sentence for his leadership in an attack on the Moncada military barracks in Santiago de Cuba, and was looking to expand his library. Revuelta was a friend and fellow rebel. The two were in the early stage of an epistolary love affair. When Revuelta suggested a book about Roosevelt's foreign policy, Castro demurred. "What I really want to document," he explained, "is FDR's program of raising agricultural prices, promoting and preserving soil fertility, providing credit, forgiving debt, expanding internal and external markets, creating jobs, reducing working hours, lifting wages, assisting the unemployed, aging, and infirm, reorganizing industry, revising the tax code, regulating trusts, and reforming banking and monetary policy. In short, just about everything he himself wanted to do for Cuba." Castro's romance with Revuelta, which lasted just shy of 6 months, produced over 100 letters, only a handful of which have ever been published in radically abridged form. The available excerpts are tantalizing, revealing a prisoner wrestling with the future of Cuba while immersed in world history and literature and contemplating the meaning of life. Sensing that the letters could help me round out the caricature of Castro that passes for authoritative biography, I reached out to Revuelta in 2014 in much the same way that Castro himself had done a half century earlier. I had material abundante, consistent with existing stereotypes, I explained. Could she help me with evidence to illuminate the real man? Cubans are wary of U.S. writers revisiting the life of a figure they continue to admire, despite his own and the revolution's deficiencies. When a friend reported that Revuelta was willing to meet me, I was hopeful, if somewhat shy of optimistic. Gazing out at me from her shaded entryway as I stood in the blazing sunshine atop the steep front stairway of her home in the New Vedado neighborhood of Havana, Revuelta had the caution of an aging beauty, accustomed to sizing up approaching predators. "Bienvenido," came a low, raspy voice from out of the shadows. I extended my hand, which she graciously accepted, her cold, bony clasp reminding me of my late grandmother. Before my eyes could adjust, she led me on to a sun-dappled terrace, its green wicker chairs surrounded by tropical plants, palm, ficus, philodendron, bird of paradise. A small electric fan whirred futilely nearby, the faint tropical aroma overwhelmed by a cigarette smoldering in a nearby ashtray full to the brim. A glass coffee table was strewn with the day's newspaper, various magazines and books, along with a few articles and photographs that seemed to have been cobbled together for me. The letters were nowhere to be seen. Clad in a sleeveless flower print dress and sandals, the once voluptuous, now reed-like Revuelta seemed to float above the tile floor. "Siéntate," she said, before continuing in perfect English. "So you're writing a book about young Fidel." Sitting down herself, Revuelta erupted in a violent cough, her frail body racked to the bone. Waving away my look of concern, she ordered an assistant to bring us coffee. Yes, I said, as she looked at me through emerald eyes with a skeptical smile and characteristic cock of her head. I want to get this story right, and I'm told you can help me. Several months and a few leisurely visits later, I heard that Revuelta was ready to share her letters with me, only to learn upon arriving at her home one afternoon that she had changed her mind. No hay problema, Nati, I said, pulling out a letter Castro had written his father from Bogota. Let me show you something I just discovered in the archives. The letter, which few have ever seen, brims with youthful innocence and detailed descriptions of the physical landscape and political economy of Panama, Venezuela, and Colombia. These voyages impart great wisdom and experience, at the same time that they open up great horizons and perspectives, Castro told his father. Revuelta read on silently, her eyes welling with tears. That's so Fidel, she murmured. That's so Fidel. She then stood up, entered her library, and returned with a thick stack of paper, which she plopped down on my lap, punctuating the moment with a single unceremonious word. Here. This book is not a defense of Fidel Castro. My aim is to recreate his life as he actually lived it, moving forward, without the benefit of hindsight. With this in mind, I ask a favor of the listener. Suspend for a moment the image you have of a bearded revolutionary clad in green fatigues, communist at conception, anti-American in utero, bilious at birth, and hearken instead to a saga that begins in a small stone farmhouse in northwest Spain at the end of the 19th century. The reward for doing so may not be a more likable Castro, but one whose aspirations, accomplishments, and failures make sense in light of the political and economic conditions that inspired and constrained them. Listeners willing to take this leap will learn a few things that may surprise them. Castro did not commit himself or Cuba to communism until after the triumph of the revolution in January 1959. He did so ultimately not as an end in itself, but as a means to the end of securing the revolution from domestic and foreign opposition, including the United States government. This argument holds both for Castro's embrace of the Cuban Communist Party in 1959 and for his alliance with the Soviet Union in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Had Castro been more successful in building a disciplined political party to match his guerrilla army before he came to power, his turn to the PSP, which had never demonstrated much interest in him or his armed struggle, would not have been necessary. Castro grew up a liberal nationalist, inspired by the unrequited dream of Cuba Libre, a Cuba free and independent of foreign rule and dedicated to the well-being of all its people. This program comprised both constitutionalism and civil rights, along with a set of social entitlements that included access to education, health care, employment, and a decent standard of living, common in Cuban cities, but harder to find in rural areas. In his late 20s, a maturing Castro tied Cuba's struggle for sovereignty and independence to a liberal tradition that encompassed the English Civil War and the American, French, Haitian, and Latin American revolutions, at the same time that he insisted that Cuba had a unique contribution to make to social and political science. Citing both Montesquieu and Simón Bolívar, he imagined Cuba charting a third way, at once democratic and socialistic. Castro's rise is incomprehensible without an understanding of Cuban history and the history of U.S.-Cuban relations, which he knew like the back of his hand. The dream of national sovereignty and self-determination was hardly unique to Cuba, but Cuba waited an especially long time for independence. When Cubans thought they had it in their grasp in 1898, the United States snatched it away, inaugurating 6 decades of political and economic subservience that haunts Cuba to this day. Throw in the constraints of the Cold War, and the fate of the Cuban Revolution seems overdetermined. Despite arguments to the contrary, the U.S. government was never prepared to recognize the revolution on Castro's original terms, making his alliance with the Soviet Union all but inevitable. Castro's liberal nationalist agenda was neither original nor inherently revolutionary. Cuban politicians had been espousing this platform since the founding of the Cuban Republic in 1902, only to become distracted upon taking office by the opportunity for financial gain. By contrast, Castro meant it when he said it, making him not only radical, but dangerous to establishment politicians, left, right, and center, as well as to the outside banks and corporations, many of them North American, which pulled the strings. Call it a fixation, call it an obsession, call it what you will. Castro experienced Cuba's subservience to the United States like a scarlet S tattooed on his chest, resolving at a remarkably young age to once and for all win Cuba's liberty, even at the cost of liberty itself. Castro regarded the struggle for Cuba Libre as part of a larger anti-colonial project that encompassed not just the rest of Latin America, but much of Africa and Asia besides. To critics, Castro's internationalism appeared at once dangerous and grandiose. U.S. officials accused Castro of meddling in other countries' affairs, as if the United States alone was authorized to do so. To Castro, as to Guatemala's Jacobo Arbenz, Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser, Vietnam's Ho Chi Minh, and countless other revolutionaries fighting to rid their nations of colonialism, it simply made sense to combine forces. There was strength in numbers. Again, this idea was hardly new at the time. Simón Bolívar and José Martí had seen it much the same way a century before. Castro was not motivated originally by money or power. He grew up on a plantation in eastern Cuba owned by his parents, which stretched 42 square miles across some of Cuba's most valuable farmland. By the time he was old enough to choose a vocation, his parents' enterprise included not only sugarcane production, but lumber, cattle, and mining operations besides. If it was money or influence he was after, he did not have to take on a U.S.-backed military dictatorship to get it. As a newly minted lawyer in 1950, he was practically granted the keys to his parents' kingdom, only to look the other way. He simply would not be domesticated. He spent much of his mid-20s making common cause with the men and women who first put their lives on the line for independence from Imperial Spain. Their work remained unfinished a century later, and Castro worried that they were being forgotten. Much of his quixotic, some would say reckless behavior, represents his attempt to reacquaint Cubans with this revolutionary tradition. Castro's solicitation for Cuban peasants and workers was deep-seated and sincere. Growing up on his parents' plantation, Castro's playmates were invariably the children of peasants and farm laborers. Returning home on school holidays, he easily fell back in among them, cherishing the local ways even as he became increasingly worldly. Crucially, his own parents were born and raised in peasant households, his father amid crushing hardship, a fact which no amount of new wealth could disguise. Observers later remarked that Castro always seemed at ease when engaging peasants and workers. This comfort was literally in his blood. As a young boy joining his father on his rounds at the cane fields, Castro witnessed more than just a conventional encounter between labor and management. These were also, at some level, exchanges between peers, his father's economic mobility providing fodder for his own Pan-American dream. Castro grew up feeling like an outsider, not an outcast exactly, but an island, vulnerable and alone. Old schoolmates describe him as preoccupied at times, even detached. During the Great Depression and periodic price collapses that afflicted Cuba's sugar economy, the Castro children never remember going hungry. This could not be said of their neighbors, and Castro recalled often scraping together leftovers to share with friends. At boarding school in Santiago de Cuba and Havana, he was greeted as a hick. Later at the university, he described feeling isolated and exposed. Later still, he grew frustrated by Cubans' passivity in the face of a stultifying status quo, as if he were the lone voice in the wilderness calling the people to a higher end. He wasn't, of course, but he saw it that way, a fact that would become increasingly important as he began to attract followers and build a movement whose outcome would depend on his ability to work productively with others. Castro believed his record of sacrifice and single-minded dedication to the cause of Cuba Libre gave him and him alone the legitimacy to lead the revolutionary struggle and eventually the revolutionary government. This too is debatable, as there were many capable opposition leaders pushed aside by fate, accident, or by Castro himself. The last man standing is not necessarily the most deserving or most qualified. Still, Castro could be excused for thinking the revolution would not have been waged, much less won, but for him. His extravagant claim to be the embodiment of the revolution stems partly from the unlikelihood of his family's rise from rags to riches and of his surviving innumerable mishaps and setbacks, including sepsis at age 7, gang warfare at the university, a foiled invasion of the Dominican Republic, revolutionary upheaval in Colombia, and the Moncada barracks attack, just to name a few. The odds against Castro surviving to win and lead the revolution appear preposterous in retrospect. Once captured after Moncada, he should never have been brought in alive. Once jailed, the key to his cell should have been thrown away. Once freed, he should have been eliminated while in exile. Once bound for home with 82 men aboard a boat built for 8, including crew, he should never have survived a botched landing. Once ashore, he should never have eluded the government ambush that reduced the 82 men to 14. Once in the mountains, he should never have outfought Batista's military. Once victorious, he should never have outlasted innumerable U.S.-backed plans, first to deny him victory, then to overthrow his government, finally to assassinate him. Considering all the pawns in the Cold War who have come and gone over the years, he should never have outlived 9 U.S. presidents, while vexing a 10th, if only posthumously. Cats have 9 lives. Castro had 9 times 9. But we make our own luck, the saying goes, and Castro was a maestro. He believed he was chosen. Given this litany, it's hard to argue with him. This does not justify many of his actions or excuse his seizing power for half a century, but it helps explain them. Only I could have done this. Only I can see this through. Finally, as with so many world historical figures, Castro's strengths were the source of his greatest weaknesses. He was at once brilliant and arrogant, charismatic and overbearing, courageous and reckless, pragmatic and quixotic. He had a killer instinct, as those in his line of work always do. Capable of real affection, he possessed a coldness at the nether reaches of the Kelvin scale. In the end, he was able to love one thing and one thing only. Not his first wife, Mirta, not his son, Fidelito, not even himself. He loved the revolution. At the height of his powers, he was said to have been able to tolerate one person on a day-to-day basis, Celia Sanchez, not a lover exactly, but someone whose commitment to the revolution rivaled his own. In waging and defending the revolution, he could be simultaneously stoical and self-pitying, forgiving and vengeful, solicitous and autocratic. Not all of these characteristics are easy to explain. Many are hard to defend. This book attempts to account for as many of them as possible. Chapter 1. Like Father. Like the fieldstone farmhouses of Láncara, Galicia, the boy born the night of December 5, 1875, to Manuel Castro Núñez and Antonia Argis Fernández, was made to last. Castro, from the Galician castrexa, Latin castrum, means castle or fort. Ángel Castro Argis, Fidel Castro's father, had the build and bearing of the granite lintel that framed the doorway of his parents' low-slung home. First and last surviving photographs reveal a figure as unyielding as inland Galicia itself, short, stout, chiseled, severe, with sagging eyelids and furrowed brow, a walled city, a castro of one. Angel was the couple's second child, the first to make it through a night. A survivor by sunrise of his natal day, Angel embodied his parents' faith, not that things would be good in Langara exactly, but that things could be better. All infants did not die in childbirth. All livestock did not succumb to wolves. The rain would cease, the cold would ease. The restoration of King Alfonso XII would end the chaos unleashed by 22 months of Republican government. For 11 years, the family's fortune held. Then the latest child went the way of the first, this time taking her mother Antonia along with her. The couple had lost its hedge with fate, and the families quickly disintegrated. Two surviving daughters were sent to live with a nearby aunt. The father remarried the next year. The boy, just 12, quit his sad and broken home in search of something better. He did not wander far at first, taking up with two sausage-making uncles in the nearby village of Armea, a patchwork of pastures, fields, and woods from Langara, on the south bank of the Neira River. 3 years later, having tired of sausage-making, Angel left home again, this time for Madrid, the nation's capital, 470 kilometers southeast of Langara, where he called on a distant aunt. Descending Spain's Cordillera Central onto the outskirts of Madrid on day 10 or so of what would become a decades-long pilgrimage, Angel would have sensed the city long before arriving in it. By 1890, Madrid was enjoying the fruits of a commercial revolution 2 generations old that had swept south and west into the heart of the Iberian Peninsula, from the port cities of Barcelona and Bilbao, and which introduced new industries and markets, new legal and political institutions, new social and civil allegiances. The revolution was surely palpable in the vibrant colors and commotion, the unfamiliar smells and tastes which greeted Angel as he approached the city. It was present, too, in the curious confidence and carelessness of the young boys and girls he met along the way, who must have regarded the country bumpkin with bemusement. This new world would prove as cruel as it was exhilarating, but its downsides would have been easy to miss as Angel crossed the Puente Segovia and disappeared into the heart of the old city. Any one of Madrid's great public squares could absorb more visitors than populated all the little villages along the Neira. The Plaza Mayor, its stalls bursting with luxuries, the Puerta del Sol with its opulent townhouses, the spanking new Jardines del Buen Retiro, where the city elite frolicked, boated, basked, and bowled, made Madrid seem less a distant metropolis in Angel's eyes than a foreign country with its own moral and political economy. Everything the boy had learned from his parents about virtue and self-discipline toppled head over heels with the nimble acrobats, spoiled children, and brazen couples on the sumptuous lawns of Buen Retiro. With time, Angel would learn to manipulate the economic levers of the new liberal order, but there is no record of him ever succumbing to its hedonism. Years later, with a family of his own, Angel insisted that his children pursue higher education. The cost of his own illiteracy was everywhere apparent in Madrid, where he found himself shut out from the lucrative clerical and administrative jobs that characterized the new commercial economy. Unqualified for meaningful work, he was cut off from the pleasures that went with it. The elegant restaurants, the hypnotic music, the coded flirtation, the casual strolls, even the rough and tumble world of sport were the province of a class above, and no amount of backbreaking work in a butchery here or bakery there could win him elevation. For 4 years, Angel toiled in vain to amass the savings that might alter his fate. Relief came not in a lucky break, but in a note from home, when in 1894, with Spain on the verge of war in Cuba, the government issued a draft decree. Ordered to attend a lottery in the Galician town of Carracedo, Angel, now 18, retraced his steps across the city, behind him a beguiling but unforgiving capital, ahead a tedious ascent up the Cordillera Central toward a future no more promising than when he first departed Langara. Unable to read or write, Angel made his mark on the world with his hands and feet. His mother's death, launched him on an extended journey that took him to Madrid and back, to Cuba and back, then back to Cuba again, finally to Oriente province in far eastern Cuba, to stay, where despite long odds he managed to establish a toehold, and eventually the financial footing that allowed him to settle down. The man who emerged from this pilgrimage was not a cultured, playful, adoring father or spouse, as we shall see, but he was a dogged worker, a reliable neighbor, and a generous benefactor, determined to provide his children the stability and education he lacked. As befits the surname Castro, Ángel was resolutely self-assured, able to get along with others when necessary, but ready to go it alone, a characteristic he passed on to his famous son. To be drafted into Spain's army in 1894 was inauspicious, even for a luckless Láncarán. Decades of corruption and neglect had rendered the Spanish army less an effective fighting force than a gentleman's club, bloated at the top, rotting at the bottom, good for little more than keeping Spaniards themselves in line. A people's army, the saying goes, is dangerous to its neighbors. A professional army is dangerous to its own people. By the time Ángel was summoned to Carracedo, Spain's army had long since ceased to provide the rank and file with decent housing, diet, sanitation, medical care, even adequate training. These are requisites not only of an effective fighting force, but of life itself. Deprived of these, Spanish soldiers expired in astonishing numbers. 10% in their first year of service, 25% over the next 4 years, bringing the toll to nearly 4 deaths for every 10 soldiers over a 5-year enlistment. And this not in war, but in peacetime, and on the Iberian Peninsula itself. To make matters worse, the nation's draft laws encouraged wealthy citizens to buy their way out of military service. This created a caste system in which regular enlistees were treated as common criminals, deployed as strikebreakers, and forced to work the fields. The Spanish public was powerless to do much about the corruption and abuse. New laws forbade criticism of the army and restricted freedom of the press. Individuals who defied the laws were made to answer in military courts. Opponents of the regime, like Carlists, arch-conservatives, and Republicans, leftists, were posted to remote and undesirable settings. The result was a rank and file populated by the most desperate and defenseless Spaniards, in short, by the likes of Ángel Castro. Ángel's draft number was not called at Carracedo. A year later, he got the opportunity to leave home again, when for the third time in a generation, Cuban separatists led by an exiled nationalist named José Martí declared independence from Spain on February 24, 1895. Desperate to attract recruits to fight in a climate Spaniards had learned to loathe, the government offered stipends payable at the stroke of a pen. Ángel promptly signed on, concluding that if things might not be better in Cuba, they could hardly be worse. By the time Manuel Castro delivered up his eldest son to the Spanish army at the port of A Coruña in August 1895, the Cuban War of Independence was 6 months old. A conflict that had elicited only the most casual shrug from the Spanish government initially had become a source of consternation across the land. For decades, senior army officers had refused postings to the Antilles, so notorious were the islands for heat, humidity, and tropical disease. In the latest flare-up, their intransigence led to the hasty promotion of reserve officers and ordinary enlistees with no experience in command of men. Combined with pre-existing problems, the inexperience proved immediately calamitous, and word reached home of skyrocketing fatalities in Cuba just as Ángel's ship set sail. The public disquiet about these developments was palpable in the grim countenances of locals who lined the lanes to the nation's seaports for one last glimpse of the flower of Spain. Mothers and sons, sisters and brothers, clung to one another in scenes of desolation. When Spanish parents said goodbye to a beloved son drafted into the army, one historian has observed, they really meant it. Ángel departed A Coruña on August 24, 1895, arriving in Cienfuegos.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?